Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, swimming in the sea would never be the same again after the film Jaws. This music here still strikes fear in the heart of anyone who's ever dipped a toe in the water. So it's a funny thing, by the time the tuba or whatever it is comes in, I'm not as scared as I was for the first 20 seconds. I feel like, whew, I made it to the shore. Fooling myself. Anyway, Jaws was the film that put a young director called Steven Spielberg on the map. Its release marks a key moment in cinema history. It spawned the genre of films known as the summer blockbuster, and this summer marks 40 years since its first release, and arts journalist John Byrne has been looking back at all of this. Now, John, Jaws, which was obviously hugely successful, was of course based on a book of the same name. Peter Benchley wrote the book, also hugely successful, by the way. So how did the book end up reaching the screen, and how closely did the film follow the book? I mean, there was a number of significant changes, weren't there?
Yeah, well, it followed the book very closely in the sense that Jaws the novel came out in early 1974, while Jaws the film was released the following summer. So it was a pretty swift transition from page to screen. The book, like you said, was an instant hit, and like any instant hit, I guess, it quickly kind of attracted the attention of movie producers. In Jaws' case, those producers were Dick Zanuck and David Brown from Universal. Now, the first person to have a crack at the screenplay was Peter Benchley himself, the author of the novel. Then, as per, you know, the Hollywood norm, the screenplay went through lots of rewrites. Spielberg had a crack at it. John Milius had a crack at it. But I think it was really Carl Gottlieb, who was a writer, an actor, and a pal of Spielberg's. He seems to be the one who really gave the film its finished shape, and Spielberg really credits him with injecting kind of warmth and humour into the film. And Gottlieb actually also has a small part in the film as the editor of the local paper on Amity Island. But in terms of the differences between the book and the film, there's lots. I mean, in the book, the shark eventually dies from harpoon wounds, which isn't kind of the most cinematic of endings. So Spielberg kind of wanted something more explosive and dramatic. And so we have the exploding shark at the end. The old sea dog Quint, played in the film by Robert Shaw, isn't a survivor of the USS Indianapolis disaster in the book. And so in the book, we don't have Robert Shaw's famous speech about the sharks tearing the survivors to pieces, etc. And it's kind of debate, by the way, about who actually wrote that speech. Was it Shaw himself? Was it John Milius? Or was it Howard Sackler or someone else who worked on screenplay? Or was it a combination of all three? I'm not sure, but it's still a hell of a speech. I think one of the biggest omissions from the book is probably the affair between Chief Brody's wife, Ellen, played in the film by Lorraine Gary, and the Ivy League kind of shark expert Hooper, played in the film by Richard Dreyfuss. Now, that's a key subtext in the book because Brody, Chief Brody, is kind of tormented by the suspicion that they're having this affair, this tension between him and Hooper. And so in the book, the shark is kind of like a symbol of a marriage falling apart, or a symbol of kind of male anxiety or impotence or whatever you're having yourself. Now, I can understand why Spielberg ditched it, because he wanted to kind of focus on the camaraderie between the three male leads. But it's a pity he did, in a way, because I kind of think it gives it an extra kind of thematic wallop.
Do you know, a funny thing is that when the book came out, it was absolutely huge. And I was working in a German factory making hinges for BMW cars. I was a wide-eyed teen. And I read the book and then I saw the movie after that. I think it's one of the first times. You know, the way people always say, oh, the book was better. This is without a doubt the movie was better. No question the movie was better. Anyway, I'm not going to do that for the moment. Because how did Steven Spielberg then, who did the extra bits, if you like, a very young Steven Spielberg, how did he get involved with the film? Because I had seen a previous one of his, which was fantastic. The one where the guy was driving along in the
Jewel.
Car. Jewel. Yeah. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. Who is this guy? Anyway, go on.
Yeah, well, he just finished working with Zanuck and Brown, the producers, on his theatrical feature film debut, The Sugarland Express. Now, I say theatrical because, of course, Jewel, which you just mentioned, that was a TV movie.
Goldie Hawn was in Sugarland Express.
That's right, yeah. Back in 71, he made Jewel. Anyway, he was apparently in the office of the producers one day and he picked up a copy of Benchley's novel, or maybe it was Benchley's first draft of the screenplay, and he read it. And he immediately saw these uncanny parallels between Jaws and Jewel because, of course, like you said, in Jewel you have Dennis Weaver being kind of pursued in his car for inexplicable reasons by this giant truck that wants to kill him. You have this kind of slow build-up of tension. You have the sense of kind of normal life being kind of turned upside down by this kind of random, unstoppable, murderous force. And you have this subtext about his marriage disintegrating. Just like in Jaws, you have tension between Brody and Ellen, his wife, about living in Amity Island versus going back to New York. So there's a real connection between the films. And I think Jewel, a fantastic film, like you said, certainly proved that Spielberg could handle tension and fear and action and human drama and all that. And he's actually talked about about Joule as a dry run for Jaws. And here's an interesting bit of trivia, actually. The sound you hear when the truck goes over the cliff at the end of Joule starts...
Ah, you're just giving away
spoiler
the
spoiler alert. I know, I'm terribly sorry. That's a sound of a dinosaur lifted from an old B-movie, and it's the very same sound you hear in Jaws after the shark has exploded and is sinking to the bottom of the sea. So there you go, bit of trivia.
Yeah, well, since you've given that bit away, the most important thing about the truck going over the cliff at the end of Joule was the fact that you never once, and you always thought you were going to, you never once saw who was driving the truck.
No, never saw the driver. I never found out why he was doing it.
Never found out why he was doing it. No, and then he became a cloud, didn't he, on TV with a horse in the city or something with his moustache down as we were.
Anyway. Oh, that's right.
All right. No, I don't mean the truck. I mean...
yeah, I was a bit confused there.
All right, okay. The casting then of Jaws. Let's take a look. I mean, an awful lot of the charm rests on how perfect the casting was. And like, when we look back at any successful movie, we always say, oh, it was perfect casting. Yeah. I mean, how do you know it was perfect casting?
I know, in hindsight, I suppose it always seems like perfect casting. I mean, but... I think, you know, not just in the case of the three main leads, I think it was spot on. I mean, OK, the three main leads, Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss were perfect. But, I mean, the supporting cast, Lorraine Gary is great, I think, and earthy and kind of warm and real as Ellen Brody. And Murray Hamilton is fantastic as Mayor Vaughan.
He just wants the beach open.
Yeah, the sleazy local mayor, and he's ignoring all the warnings. He wants to keep the beaches open. He wants money pouring into the island. As for the three leads... Apparently, Spielberg was kind of reluctant at first to cast Roy Scheider as Chief Brody because he was afraid that he had too much of a tough guy persona, like you'd seen in films like Sorcerer, The French Connection, The Seven Ups and films like that. But of course, he turned out to be perfect. He'd kind of just the right mix of grit and kind of anxiety and warmth and vulnerability. And actually, there's two great Roy Scheider moments that kind of spring to mind. One is where the three leads are on the boat on the Ark at night and they're sitting in the cabin drinking and comparing scars.
Yeah.
And Richard Dreyfuss shows off a scar on his arm from a moray eel bite and Robert Shaw shows off a scar from a thresher shark and they're drinking and being macho and trying to outdo each other. And we cut to poor old Roy Scheider as Brody and he kind of just silently pulls up his jumper and looks at his appendix scar. And it's a lovely little moment because it says he's a city boy, he doesn't belong on that boat, he kind of feels intimidated by them and insecure.
He's
and all
a
that.
Dad.
He's a dad, yeah. He's a normal guy, he's an every man. And the second great moment, speaking of dads, is okay, it's a typically Spielbergian one, maybe a little bit sentimental, but he's in his home, he's drinking alone.
Hold on, before you even say that, hold on, look.
You heard him, slow ahead. Slow ahead. I can go slow ahead. Come on down and chump some of this.
You know, I got confused there thinking that was him looking out saying, I'm going to need a bigger boat. But that was him when I was thinking about getting the kid in, wasn't that it? From the water. Is that what you were going to say? It probably wasn't what you were going to say when he was drinking alone.
No, it's, you know, he's drinking alone at home after the kid has died. And there's this lovely scene between him and his son where they kind of mirror each other's actions. And it finishes with him saying, remember, he says, come here and give me a kiss. And the son says, why? And Brody says, because I need it. And it's, okay, it's a sentimental moment, but it's just kind of warm and real and kind of lovely in that very Spielberg kind of way.
It brought a tear to your young teen eye.
It did, and it still does.
Good. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. The film was hit by lots and lots of problems. It went over time, went over budget, the mechanical sharks didn't work very well. If you ever go to Universal Studios, one of the big things, the mechanical shark comes up to you, and anybody under the age of 8 on the boat freaks out and starts crying.
Yeah. I mean, it was hit by a lot of problems. Like the budget, for example, was originally supposed to be, I think, about $4 million. That spiralled up to $9 million. And like you said, the sharks kept breaking down, the mechanical sharks. They got kind of tangled in seaweed. They took on water. The salt water kind of messed up their inner workings and so on. And most of the problems, and Spielberg admits this, were caused by his own kind of naivety, by wanting to shoot on the open ocean rather than a tank in a studio, as maybe a more experienced director would have done. And obviously that was a decision that was good for the look of the film. It made the film look fantastic, but it just made everything much more difficult. And Spielberg kind of later claimed, he was naive. He just didn't realise how difficult it was to film in the sea and at sea. And even the crew started dubbing the movie Flaws because, I mean, it went 100 days over schedule, which is pretty spectacular. And, you know, the cast and crew kept coming up to him and saying, when is this thing ever going to get finished? And Spielberg said, look, he couldn't give them a straight answer. He'd no idea if it ever would get finished or how long it might take. And he even thought, you know, this could be the movie that finishes my career. It's only just started, but it'll be finished by this. You know, this is going to be a disaster. Nobody's ever going to hire me again. And of course, it turned out to be the biggest film of all time at the time. So all of that was quickly forgotten.
And isn't it fair to say that, like, you know, some of the problems turned out to be fantastic yeah. solutions, because the mechanical sharks didn't work. So we had to kind of suggest, like, at least show a suggestion of the shark more, and a suggestion means more attention.
Yeah, of course. I mean, now it's not entirely clear how much all of that was intended. I mean, I've heard Spielberg say, you know, that they'd always intended for the shark to be kind of largely unseen. I've also heard him suggest it was just born out of necessity. The sharks were broken most of the time, so what could they do? And I've heard it suggested that the opening scene, which is the attack on Chrissy, the young woman who's kind of skinny dipping at night, that was supposed to actually show the shark. But because the sharks weren't working, they had to kind of rewrite the scene so you see her kind of
really?
Yanked about.
Oh, that would have been terrible.
Yeah, it would have been terrible.
Much better with
that. That's why I kind of doubt that that's true, because I think it works so much better. You know, obvious to anybody that it works better. Yeah. Never reveal the monster too soon, especially not in the first scene of the movie, you know, kind of because it builds attention and anticipation and all that. So I doubt that one is true. But it's you know, it's a rumour. But for most of the movie, like you kind of said, I mean, it's the presence of the shark is kind of hinted at. I mean, it's hinted at through John Williams' obviously very famous Jaws theme, which you heard in the start, which is obviously one of the most, you know, instantly recognisable pieces of film music ever. Yeah. There we go. I mean, it just unsettles you, kind of sets you on edge. It's kind of like Bernard Herrmann's music in Psycho, you know.
Yeah, to me, it's not up there with that, actually.
No.
It wouldn't be number one. No, Psycho's number one.
Psycho's number one in terms of, yeah, setting you on edge. But the other thing is, you knew it was there because of these yellow barrels, which was a great kind of visual device. You know, these yellow barrels on the surface of the water that they'd fired into the shark to keep it near the surface. That told you the shark was there as well without seeing the mechanical shark.
Yeah.
And I think, so whether it was like by accident or design, that's debatable. You know, it was clearly a masterstroke. It kind of gave the film, Spielberg's kind of mentioned this, the feel of these subtle kind of horror flicks that Val Lewton produced for RKO in the 1940s, like Cat People, where the monster was kept off screen yeah. or held back or hinted at. And of course, like you said, that immediately builds tension if you can manage to do that.
And one of the things I said at the very beginning was that the whole idea of the summer blockbuster, and this is a huge genre of kind of like, well, loads of money, frankly.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and wasn't this the first?
Yeah, and the weird thing is that traditionally summer had been seen by studios as a pretty dead time for the cinema business. I know that seems strange now. So studios would kind of dump their low-grade and their low-budget films into cinemas. And,
well, summer
and
in Ireland certainly is. yeah. In America.
In America,
they,
I mean.
Yeah, but like, don't they go to the cinema to get away, to get some air conditioning? I think a lot of that is happening now.
Yeah. Go because of the air conditioning, yeah. But I mean, the movie going at the time was primarily seen as a kind of a winter activity. Now, Jaws was released in June. And that changed all that. And now, of course, summer is the time for studios to kind of release their big budget and their slam-bang wallop spectaculars. So Jaws changed that. But one other thing it changed, you could argue, and it's often been argued, that it was a kind of a nail in the coffin, maybe a final nail in the coffin of the kind of new Hollywood that had come out of Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde and Midnight Cowboy and all those movies in the late 60s and early 70s. And those films that kind of emerged from this sort of dying, collapsing studio system, and films that seemed to offer something fresh and something new, kind of an alternative to Hollywood's usual studio fare. And after Jaws, the theory goes, studios basically saw the future, and that the future they saw was, you know, lavish, spectacular, high concept, usually dumb, big budget blockbusters. And of course, that's a legacy we're still living with
today.
And
hello, Marvel Comics, etc.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, listen, look, John, thank you very much indeed, as in arts journalist John Byrne, for talking to us. 40 years of Jaws at the cinema and 40 years of the summer blockbuster. I'll end up with this piece here. See you, John. Thanks a million.
Cheers,
good luck. All right, take it easy.
Chief Brody, you are uptight. Nice. Come on. That's it.